Hello, it's me, Sam Dunnewald. I'm here before the show to tell you that I am kickstarting my first standalone in-print RPG, Band-Aids and Bullet Holes. It's a John Wick-inspired game of bloody revenge inside a tight-knit clique of professional assassins. It's a one-shot capsule game, box set, deck builder, and it's the end result of 3 years of interviews and ideation on all things game design right here on Dice Exploder. If you like the show, if you like how I think about game design, I think you're really going to love this game. I really just want you to know about it. I want you to play it. And you can follow the Kickstarter page right now at a link in the show notes. You can back the game starting May 5th. That's it. Thanks so much for listening, as always. I hope you check out the game. Here's Dice Exploder. Hello and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week we take a tabletop mechanic and rank it against its peers. My name is Sam Dunnewald and my co-host today is Nico MacDougall. Welcome back, Nico, to the show. Good to have you.
Glad to be here again.
We're just diving straight into it today without an intro because today we're here to talk about the awards. The awards are, you guessed it, an awards show for tabletop RPGs that Nico, you are running these days. Can you tell us a little bit about the awards? What's the deal with the awards? Why are you here?
Yeah, the awards is an indie TTRPG awards show. We recognize 20 best things a year, essentially. And the thing that I think sets it apart is both that it is 20 best things, but those are not ranked within themselves. There is no number one. There is no number 20. It's just 20 things that are worthy of attention, cool, weird, artsy, whatever metric the judges decide to use. And then the other thing is that of late, I've taken more and more steps to sort of focus that and ensure that we're looking at smaller, weirder games or any sort of TTRPG adjacent thing, that stuff like the Ennies or even IGDN's Diana Jones, you know, whatever else there is, might not get as much attention in.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a cool awards show. I think I want to talk a little bit about ranking things before we get like too far into this episode. Broadly speaking, what we're going to do here today is like highlight a few of the last cycle of awards entries and some mechanics from them that we love in classic sort of Dice Exploder fashion. But I don't know, ranking things I have such a love-hate relationship with that probably goes back to my love-hate relationship with the John Cusack movie High Fidelity. But like, I really find ranking things to be so much fun. I have done so much of it in my life and I will continue to do it until the day I die. I just find it to be a really compelling way to, it's like a solo game, right? It's like a means of self-expression and also then of like a framework for conversation about art. And that framework has some severe limitations because you are like ranking things that really don't need to be compared. And like saying one piece of art is better than another piece of art is silly in the first place. And I think a lot of people, a lot of bros in a lot of communities, just humans at large, really have a tendency to say like, we have to get to an objective ranking, you know, like this thing is better than that thing. And that's just, I don't know if that's healthy for anyone, but I don't know. Just the act of doing it is fun and brings me joy as long as you don't take it very seriously. And something I like about the awards is they're sort of doing as little ranking as possible while still fundamentally being a ranking activity, and that you are sort of like seeking out a specific niche to be an awards show within that is really vibes based and sort of like meanders year to year based on what the judges tend to, what kind of judges you can tend to bring into things. So I don't know. I find the whole prospect very interesting. I should say I was a judge along with you in the first year that they were active when someone else was running them. But I just wanted to check in with you and be like, so what do you think about awards show at large? Like, why do you care about this thing enough to run it?
Yeah, I also feel like I have a funny relationship with ranking things because people always ask, you know, like, well, what's your favorite book or what's your favorite movie or what's your favorite food or whatever? And I feel like I've never had what I feel like are good answers to that. Yes, like, yeah, what's your favorite book? And all of a sudden I'm like, I've forgotten every single book I've ever read. I can tell you things that I like. I can tell you the thing that I've read the most recently that I like the most, you know, or that I found most interesting or whatever. But yeah, I feel like I've always had a difficult time with that sort of really, really regimented idea of ranking, which is part of what I really enjoyed about the awards back when I, you know, the first time it happened when I was a judge for it, and why I've kept going with this is because the process for judging the awards, the initial thing is like you're saying, like, is this good enough, sort of a yes no vote to like be considered further. And then once you have your sort of little pool of finalists, then it's like you distribute some votes based on what you like the most. So you could give one vote to 20 things or 20 votes to one thing. But then at the end of all of that, there's no revelation of like who got the most votes out of anything. It's just like the 20 things that sort of got the most votes collectively. And so I think it's a really interesting way to arrive at a consensus of good, interesting art out of a larger pool based on the opinions of 8 to 12 people, basically. It is ranking, obviously. You're ending up with 20 things that are being said as like, well, these are the best things that we got. But you're not trying to get so granular as to be like, well, this is number one, and this is number two, and this is number three. And what I'm more interested in is like, what sets apart a pool of good, interesting, artsy, weird stuff from other things? Maybe it's because they ask interesting questions. Maybe it's because they just do one specific thing really, really well. And I feel like that's what we've sort of consistently ended up with the awards in the 3 years that we've done it.
Yeah. So before we get into specifics again, tell me about people can apply to be judges. People can submit their games to the awards. What are the kind of deadlines here? How can people participate in this if it sounds compelling to them?
Yeah. So we'll be accepting judge self nominations in the month of April. There'll be a Google form on the website. I'll be sharing it on social media. The website is theawards.games. The thing that I want to particularly note this year is that I've sort of made this like a public commitment that at least 50% of the judging panel, which is usually like 12 people, will be people of color, and at least 50% will be people of a marginalized gender identity. And those are not obviously mutually exclusive. I have loved the judging panels that we've gotten in the past, but I want to make sure that minority groups within the tabletop role-playing game community know that I am specifically interested in hearing their thoughts and want them to be involved in this. And I'm hoping that also inspires people to submit games as well. Speaking of which, the games will be, or, you know, games, podcasts, art, essays, you know, what have you. You can submit those through a different form, but that's the month of May. So anything published, and this is where things are a little weirder than usual, anything published between June 1st, 2024 and May 31st, 2025 is eligible.
Yeah, and we're looking backwards a little bit here.
Part of this is because I personally think it's just a little funny to kind of pick up where we left off, because I did not do the awards last year because I had done it 2 years in a row and was a little burned out on it, but always wanted to bring it back. And then the other element is that I'm hoping that the looking backwards a little bit is going to both give some more attention to things that maybe weren't as well disseminated, distributed, what have you, when they came out, and also to eliminate some element of recency bias.
Yeah, totally. I will say everyone should go do this. I think participating in the awards is really cool. I think the awards becomes better the more people participate in it. I also think it's a lot of work to judge the awards. Like, I really think if you are excited about participating in this at all, like, you should do it. When I did this, it was like super influential on how I think about games. Like, I think it was one of the things that led to me starting Dice Exploder was how much conversation about games I was able to have during that judging process. I just wanted to say up front, like, it's a wonderful thing to do. It's also a significant time commitment, right?
Absolutely.
That's the heads up I want to give people.
For sure.
So check it out. But with all that said, let's talk about some of the games from last time. So these were all games that were published in the 23 to 24 kind of cycle. So I believe June 2023 through the end of May 2024.
Mm-hmm.
You have picked our first game that we're going to kind of spotlight here. What is it and what mechanic have you pulled from it?
Yes, our first game is Cloud Empress by Watt. This is a mothership hack, although I suppose it's more accurately Panic Engine. And the mechanic that I have chosen is that you gain a stress whenever you draw your weapon, and also when someone draws their weapon on you. And the reason I've chosen this is because, and I sort of looked back through what I could find in the Mothership rules that, again, it's obviously based on, to sort of compare it. And a lot of the stress triggers in that game are mostly on sort of like failure of various roles, right? You know, you're like, you're making a save, you're making an attack, whatever. If you fail, you, it's like you often take like a D10 of stress or something like that. So it's very variable. It can really change the tenor of a scene if all of a sudden you're like, oh, I've taken a lot of stress, and that's like obviously a very bad thing because it triggers panic, it triggers bad other bad things to happen, it can create a little bit of a death spiral, but that's also sort of the point. But in Cloud Empress, there are other triggers specifically that, you know, for like when you take one stress, but I wanted to focus on this one because it's, I find it really interesting that it's directly addressing sort of like other effects of violence, or not even violence, mm-hmm. right? They don't mm-hmm. even have to be attacked. Like, it's just like, it's aggression.
This is a mechanic that is so clearly about violence, but not through mechanizing violence itself, but through mechanizing the threat of violence, right? Like, it right. is, it is saying like one of the most important parts of violence is the sort of hovering ghost of it.
Yeah, yeah. The like, the hand sort of like, like in a sort of like a Western, right? Like the yeah. hands hovering over a gun, right? Not the 100% same metaphor, but yeah, exactly. It's like the idea of like building into the rules, like, hey, when you draw a weapon, like you are changing something about the scene, right? Like you are changing something about the action that is happening. It's changing yeah. you. It's changing like the people that you're interacting with, that you're talking to, that you're like threatening now, presumably. Right. You could argue that like that sort of happens already. Right. Like whenever you draw a weapon, like if you describe drawing a weapon in a game, it's like, yeah, you've changed this from a conversation to a threat, to a fight, to aggression, what have you. But building that into the panic engine of it all, of like, yeah, you get stress. The more stress you have, the more likely you are to panic. When you panic, worse things happen to you. You have the chance to just potentially die. Like if you get too stressed, you can just like essentially have a heart attack. And it makes you really think about those actions, right? You really have to think about like, okay, like is violence, is drawing a weapon, is even making a threat the right thing to do here? Yeah. Is that the right thing for my character? Is that the right thing for anyone else's character?
Yeah, really cool mechanic. I think Cloud Empress just generally being a hack of Mothership that looks very, very different from Mothership. Definitely, it's a very cool product. I'm glad it got recognized here.
Yeah.
And I know they've done a lot of building on it and community building around it since it won this award, too. So people should definitely check yeah. it out.
And I think the last thing that I'll say, too, that I really like about it is the sort of modularity of it, right? I mean, not yeah, just yeah. this particular line or these two triggers, but like the listing of triggers of like gain one stress when this happens really opens up designed for future supplements or even adventures, where mm-hmm. if you want to customize the environment or the vibe right. of like, you know, of a dungeon or a social encounter or whatever, or of a whole, again, a whole module, you can say like, oh yeah, when you're in this location or when you're talking to this person, you gain a stress when X thing happens. Again, yeah. not like you couldn't do that with Mothership, but like by putting it into the base rules, by building it into the engine from the jump, I think it really sort of highlights that as like a, this is a really yeah. potentially interesting and fruitful place to do some design, even just in like a home game.
Yeah, I mean, it would be trivial to take this rule and drop it into your Mothership game, right?
Right.
Cool stuff. All right, so my first pick is from Border Riding by Joe Reed, which is a game about a particular location and like a community within that location and how that location's borders change across generations or decades or certain amounts of time. Basically, like every time you'll like play out a little bit of story and then you'll jump forward in time and redraw the map of what your thing looks like. And you'll like keep doing this over and over and the map keeps changing. But also like part of this is that the game comes in the form factor of like an old road trip glove box map that you like open and like fold out, and it has this huge gorgeous map on it with all the rules of the game in the margins around the central giant map. And that's the mechanic that I'm picking. It's like the four factor of this game, right? Like it's so cool. It's so easy to imagine taking this thing, folding it out and like setting it on the center of the table. Once you have done that, looking up rules seems way easier. It's also, it's just, I love the idea of games don't have to be books. Like they can come in other forms. Like you can do something else with the game. Like this road trip map really puts you in the mindset of like, this is a game about space and like territory and landscape and like everything that you would associate with that. Like the paper itself, once you've unfolded everything, it's so large that makes the thing feel expansive. Like just the form factor of this thing, it's neat, but then it also like creates a emotional experience in you as you are just imagining playing the game, and then again once you sit down at the table to actually play it. And I find that really cool. I want to find somewhere in the United States that'll just like print me stupid maps like this so I can make a game like this. And I also want to like, I want people to figure out how to like put games on, you know, cupcake wrappers or whatever too, you know. Like just like,
oh yeah,
I feel like the fact that this game is such a playable game not in a traditional form factor is just really, really cool.
And that also really comes through even when you don't have the physical product, because that's the thing with the awards, is that we only have digital products. Like, even in the digital format, they have a PDF of like the whole, just like what the image of it all laid out would look like, right? Like of the map. But they also just had like the rules like in a little booklet form, because they also provide, I think it's, that's probably the digital only version, is like a little booklet. And like, I 100% agree that the physical product of the game is so genuinely impressive and like an undeniable factor of how you engage with the game. But like, even if you don't have the ability to get that original physical version, like the themes and like the message of the game like comes through even in just the rules, and like the physical map product of it only like enhances that. It's not like you must have the map product in order to get something out of the game, you know. And I think that,
although if you
like,
did, so if you cool. had to have the map product, I might like it even more. You know, like I do think that there is something like,
if the game was fully unplayable
so
without
specific
the map
about that. Well, I'm thinking now about an earlier year of the awards recognized Tim Hutchings, A Collection of Improving Exercises, as I recall, which is a game. Loosely, maybe it's a game. It's a game-like object that is styled as a, basically an old how to learn to draw book.
It had like weird stuff going on there. Exercises and stuff.
Yeah, but it's also like the way Tim presented that was like, hey, my name's Tim Hutchings, and I like found this old palette of books published in 1928, and now you can buy one from my website, right? And he really commits to the bit of that, of like, that's what this thing is. And so the physical product, you kind of need to like play the thing, because you are supposed to be doing this drawing, and the game really wants you to be doing this drawing in the book itself. But
So
the digital version is like a PDF that's like a poorly scanned at a public library ass like PDF, you know, like, and then the digital format, like it commits to that framing device around the game. Right. And in that way, I like games that are committing to their thing, whatever that thing is, you know. And if you are changing media from digital to physical, embracing that change and adapting to that change is really exciting to me. And I do think Border Riding does that.
No, it is very interesting. The kinds of games that sort of demand a certain way of engaging with them. Like, it's not like they're unplayable otherwise, right? It's not like you can't, you know, like part of the whole sort of benefit of tabletop games is the ability to like to play around with it and change its like context and rules if you want, even, and et cetera, et cetera. But when it's a game like this where it's basically an old like street map that you, or like map of the US, that you'd have to like unfold, you had to like, a co-pilot had to have the whole map unfolded in the car next to you, next to a driver, like that's gonna change how you play it. And if you play it in a different way, it's not like you're not playing the game, but you are playing kind of a different game.
Yeah.
The Badlands. Legend has it that beneath the dust, something old and powerful still whispers to any gunslinger foolish enough to listen. One day, aboard a doomed train into the wastes, three unlucky travelers hear that call. A runaway socialite, a shape-shifting bounty hunter, and a retired thief turned family man. Will our outcasts find what they're looking for?
I mean, we're already here. Let's have a little fun.
You really went in there, guns blazing.
I thought that was the plan.
My potions are miraculous.
I thought we were being quiet.
Oh, Stump only has one volume. Sorry.
Wild roses grow out of his mouth, having filled his lungs.
What's happening out there?
Violence.
Find out on Mage Hand High Five.
This episode of Dice Exploder is sponsored by Hero Forge. Hero Forge offers fully customizable tabletop miniatures with dozens of fantasy species and thousands of parts to choose from, all within your browser. And these minis come in a variety of materials, including bronze, color standees, and color plastic options, or download model files for your minis and 3D print their unique designs right in your own home. Hero Forge also has custom printed dice where they'll stick your favorite mini floating inside a die or put that mini on a keychain. Hero Forge custom acrylic keychains are printed at the same scale as the rest of Hero Forge minis and arrive already attached to a high quality zinc alloy lobster clasp so you can take your favorite character wherever you go. Hero Forge is constantly expanding its catalog of customization options, adding new parts every week, so check back in and see what you've missed. Visit heroforge.com to start designing your custom miniature and dice today.
This episode of Dice Exploder is brought to you by Die Meta Dungeon. Die Meta Dungeon is a campaign-length, dungeon-based adventure for the Die RPG that is also a crawl through 60 years of tabletop RPG history. In Die Meta Dungeon, your characters will enter a massive dungeon that grows deeper and more dangerous as more people succumb to the honeyed allure of role-playing games. Dungeon crawl your way through every era of gaming, from the 1970s to the present day, one decade per dungeon level. Survive to the end, and you might learn something. For the first time in the Die RPG, player characters will get to return to the real world between levels of the dungeon, trying to juggle their real-life problems, and maybe even apply some of the important things they've learned about themselves in the dungeon, before being drawn inexorably back into the meta dungeon. It's a classic fantasy mega dungeon campaign with a postmodern twist, and at least 6 months of sessions baked into it. Die Meta Dungeon is on BackerKit through April 2026. This episode of Dice Exploder is brought to you by Orbital Blues Month. 1 month, 6 creators, an entire outlaw galaxy to explore. Orbital Blues is an RPG of sad space cowboys where your crew of desperate and downtrodden outlaws travel across a music-infused space western universe filled with retro-future technology plagued by heartbreak and the haunting shadow of the blues. And through the end of April on BackerKit, 6 creators are all running projects that expand the Orbital Blues universe. Check out Outlaws and Corporations from Soul Muppet Publishing, a book filled with NPCs, adventures, and setting inspiration. Formula Infinity from Plus One EXP, a high-octane space racing adventure complete with bespoke mechanics for racing. Or A Fistful of Stars from Stations, an interwoven series of adventures set on an interstellar train line. Or any of 3 other projects. Each project also comes with a soundtrack from Behold, which you're listening to part of right now, and which you can get as a limited edition cassette tape when you back multiple projects. Orbital Blues Month, through the end of April, on BackerKit. Check it out. All right, what's your second pick?
My second pick is how to introduce this. So there is a collection of 3 games, and the collection is called Forgotten Palaces by Anna Anthropy. And within that collection, there is a game called This Maze Will Be Big Enough to Call Home Someday. And the game is about basically a group of kids making their dream video game in 1990X. So some sort of abstract period in the 90s. And it's not quite like an ASCII-based like visual design. It's not quite like original Dwarf Fortress. But it's kind of like that, where you're like drawing rooms and like sort of building a dungeon, building a game, and putting these characters that is provided in the game onto the dungeon to represent various things. But the specific mechanic that I'm looking at, that I'm calling out here, is in the ending the game section. And so it reads, when every room on the map has a name, in parentheses, remember, rooms added by players are named immediately, the game is wrapping. It's really... there's something very sort of like emotional about reading that, because the idea is that like at the beginning of the game, you start with a certain number of unnamed rooms. There's like a provided map that has like some that are already drawn. Or of course, if you just want to start fully blank, like you can just draw a bunch of empty rooms yourself and then sort of start playing. But it's like a sort of Damocles sort of hanging over your head, you know, of like this idea of like we have full control over like when we end this game. But we also don't, because other people are playing. So, like, if everyone agrees, then, like, yeah, you could never end the game, right? And much like a video game that gets stuck in development hell, you could be like, we're going to keep making this bigger. We're never going to stop making this game. It's never going to be done. Or you could all decide, like, yeah, like, okay, I think we're kind of done. You know, let's end the game now. Or if ideally this would be in character, but you could have this kind of conflict between actual players as well. You could have someone who's like, I'm actually done making this. I want to be finished. And everyone else is like, no, we want to keep going. But you can't stop them from naming those unnamed rooms. So it's this really like, it's pointing you towards like, hey, you like you have control over like when the game is done. You don't have to judge it based on like when it sort of feels right, or like when the deck of cards runs out. It's like you have the choice of when to finish it, but also that comes with its own sort of like threat and promise of like, what will it feel like to finish it? What will it feel like at the end when we name our last unnamed room? Like, the game is wrapping. We're done making the game. And again, like we were sort of talking about with border writing, it's like it's very tactile. It's very physical. It's visual too, right? Because you have it in the middle of your play space. It's what you're engaging with constantly. You're sort of like looking at it and you see things filling up and it's getting bigger, but also it's kind of getting smaller in a sense, because like, the moment you name an unnamed room, the game is that much closer to being done.
Yeah. I don't get as much of an emotional reaction to this as you. Games end, you know, and everything ends. Like, everything like gets to that point eventually. And I think that there's not a lot here that is like making me feel that more than typical. But I really do appreciate any game that calls out its ending. Like, I think role-playing games at large have a really bad habit of not telling you when to expect an ending or how to conclude playing them. Sometimes that's one-shot games. Sometimes that's, very frequently, that's campaign-length games. But I think that it's really, really helpful in play to have that sense of pacing of like, are we halfway through this? Are we a quarter of the way through this? Like, I know because of my experience as a human being with story structures like embedded in my brain, I know what kinds of swings to take when in the process, if you are making that process and its duration really clear to me. And yeah, so anything that is like intentionally laying out really early on, this is when the game is going to end, is really welcome to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see why you might not have the same sort of emotional like connection to it. But the reason that I've identified that the reason why it is like I get that is because of like the framing device of like you're a bunch of kids who are like making this game. Right. And so like I'm imagining in play, it's like it provides an interesting outlet for both ending the game, but also for like introducing conflict between the characters. Right. Where it's like where you can have that sense of like, of these kids where someone can be like, well, I want to do this thing. No one else is feeling that. And they're like, okay, I'm going to act out and like get us closer to ending the game. And like, that's a really interesting way to demonstrate that. Like, obviously you can just say that, but you can also take a very material step towards doing that. And I also like, I mean, I was born in the 90s. I was a child and have very few actual memories in that period of time. And I've never made, you know, like a video game, but it also feels very sort of nostalgic in that sense of like thinking back to like as a kid of like playing and sort of like not wanting that play to end, but also like knowing that it will, kind of like you were saying, like, you know, like things end and like that, that's what happens. And like, as a kid, I feel like I both knew that and also hoped it wouldn't happen, essentially. Right. Yeah. And I'm seeing a similar, I'm like connecting a similar vibe to that, at least in my own experience, in this, of that sense of like, yeah, like it's going to end. We know that we're adults. Not only do we know that things end, we also have like X number of hours to play this game that we decided to sit down and give our time to. But it does that double duty of like bringing a sort of thematic element of the framing device to the forefront while also just sort of respecting the player's time and giving them a clear out for like, hey, like you can, like you're gonna, like the game is wrapping, the game, like the game will be finished, the game will be complete, but it also leaves you open the possibility of like, but like, is the game done, quote unquote? Like, did the kids make the game that they actually wanted to make? Like, did they have a complete game? And we're like, wow, we really did that, and we made the perfect game exactly like we wanted. You know, dust hands, job's done, right? Like, it's both a very practical mechanic and also something that can sort of expand out beyond that a little bit.
Yeah. All right. My second pick, our last game today, is Stirring the Hornet's Nest at Het Thumsia. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but here we are. It's by Meng Kao, and it is an adventure module. It is a dungeon. The premise of this adventure is that there's a monk who's been meditating for about 10 years and is getting very close to the end of his meditation. But in the time that he has been meditating, a giant nest of bees has taken root inside of his meditation dungeon, and the monks outside need you to go in and rescue him so that he can complete his meditation in safety away from the giant bees. And, you know, there are all sorts of like automaton guardians that have been set up to keep people from coming in and interfering with his meditation. So it's going to be like a tough time getting in there, getting this guy, and then getting out again without jostling him so much that he wakes up. And that's the mechanic that I really like here, is just this guy. Like, this is a dungeon where, like, there's a you have a very clear goal from the outset that is not just, like, grave robbing, you know? I always appreciate that in a dungeon. But I also really like a dungeon or any game where, like, you are given one fictional toy to play with, like, one thing that the dungeon is kind of, like, based around. And here that is, escort this meditating man. You can't drop him or make loud noises around him or speak directly to him or he'll wake up, and like that would be really bad. Then mission, game over. It also plays into something I really love in kind of storytelling at large, which is the most interesting answer to what should this thing be is a person. So like you can easily imagine like getting to the point where it's like, I've got this dungeon where I want to like escort a thing through the dungeon. Like, what should the thing be? The most interesting answer is probably a person. Like, here's this person. Let's have a relationship with this guy and like the mythology around him. And then like in practice, is he a guy or is he just like some gear that you're lugging around? I don't know. But I like this so much conceptually. I think it's just such a strong premise for a dungeon and makes all the different factions in the dungeon feel cohesive because they're all kind of like tied into that core premise too. It's just really smart design. Good writing.
Yeah. Well, I think what you're saying, like it is interesting what you said, like the sort of the sense of like, oh, is this a guy or like some gear, right? And the adventure does not say like this is going to happen, but it's not hard to extrapolate that like if you wake up this monk before the 10-year process is complete, he and all the other monks are going to be upset, like, you know, and that doesn't mean they're necessarily going to like attack you.
You got big stakes though.
Exactly. It's like, but honestly, it would probably be that much worse for them to like, for him to wake up and be like, oh, I'm very disappointed. You know,
you're
like,
yeah, totally,
oh
totally.
No, like, I've disappointed this guy that I was supposed to help. Like the abbot, the disciples, you know, whoever else is around. And I think that is, I think for a lot of people can feel like a more, you know, can feel like a more like consequential outcome than just like, oh, I didn't get paid, you know, or even like a, oh, I failed to bring this powerful magical artifact somewhere and I didn't seal a great evil. It's like, yeah, you know that you should be upset about that. I don't think you feel that in the same way as like a meditating monk who wakes up and is like, oh, but I was so close and then you ruined it. And that is making me sad and upset.
Yep. So those are some of our favorites from last time on the awards. Again, I mean, we said all this up top, but let's close out again with telling people how they can get involved here, right? So April, you can submit yourself as a judge, or you can tell your friends that they should submit themselves as judges. And really, I don't think I want to say about this. If you don't think that you're qualified, I promise you that you're qualified. Like
100%.
Once you have read 200 games or 100 games or whatever it ends up being, like, you will be qualified to make judgments about those games. So get yourself in there, or whoever in your community is interested, apply to be a judge. And then in May, submit all your stuff that got published between, what were the dates again?
Basically June 2024 to May 2025.
And then what can we expect in terms of the process from the awards? Like, when are the winners going to get announced? When's the judging going to happen? All that kind of fun stuff.
Yeah, so judging will be from June to August for the first round. And then after votes go in for that first round, there'll be another shorter period, maybe 8 weeks. And then winners will be selected and announced in a live stream, channel TBD.
Yeah.
And that will be in October-ish.
And remember that you can submit not just games, also like Lyrical Ludology, a great podcast that I believe is crowdfunding its second season right now for post-production, won an award in the last cycle. The only reason Dice Exploder hasn't been submitted in the past is because I judged for them and I felt like there was a conflict of interest there. Like, if you're making stuff that is around games also, you should get in there, submit that stuff too.
If you don't think it qualifies, A, it might, and B, that can also be up to the judges to decide.
Yeah. Nico, thanks for coming back on Dice Exploder. One day we'll have you on for a normal format episode, but not yet.
I'm happy, you know, I'm happy to be able to talk about multiple things in one episode, even if we could make full episodes out of any of these.
Thanks again to Nico for being here. Again, you can apply to be a judge for the awards in April, and you can submit all your work in May. Check for links in the show notes. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon. You can follow Nico on Blue Sky at Gigantic Spider. You can find me on Blue Sky at Dice Exploder, and you can find my games at sdunnewald.itch.io. Our logo is designed by Sporgery. Our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray, and our ad music is Lily Pads by my boy, Travis Tesmer. And thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time. I gotta go make lunch.